Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. On a day when she doesn't have plans, Kat Warren is always hopeful she might get a call. But here's the thing. The invitations she waits for are not limited to an impromptu game of tennis or a glass of wine with a friend. Kat Warren is also up for trekking the wilderness with her highly trained dog, helping in the search for a dead human body. She takes no pleasure in the deaths themselves, but she is deeply proud of the way she can help lead authorities to answers and evidence in missing persons cases. And it all started, as she'll tell us, when she brought home a puppy she feared would never be a good companion. Kat Warren is professor of science journalism and creative nonfiction at North Carolina State University, and she is a cadaver dog handler. Her new book is called What the Dog Knows: Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. Kat, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So it goes without saying that you did not grow up dreaming of being a cadaver dog handler. I suppose that would be disturbing in any child. But you'd had lots of dogs and felt pretty confident about your ability to train them until you brought Solo home. How was he different from the start from other puppies that you'd raised?
Well, he was a miserable little beast. David, my husband, and I were astonished because the night he arrived home with us, and we had sort of driven from Ohio back to our home, and he walked in the door and mounted our poor adopted Irish setter, and she looked at us just with this horrific, "You didn't do this." And you know, when I removed him, he turned around and bit me. And by the end of that night, I was a little black and blue on my arms, and I was crying in my husband's arms saying, "I don't like him." And David said, "Well, we'll just return him." We didn't do that, obviously. But how he was different was that he was a singleton. He had no litter mates. He was an only pup. And we come to find out that those dogs have special challenges learning how to get along with other dogs because they don't get that early litter interaction. And it often makes them dog aggressive because they simply don't speak dog talk, and they give miscues to other dogs and vice versa. And that's what I had with Solo.
Yeah, I had never realized until reading your book. First of all, I didn't know there were many singletons out there, but I had never realized that that was such an issue. And like the scrum of a litter teaches a lot of important skills that we can't really teach a dog.
Yes, and when you think about it, and all of us, I think, have seen or experienced puppies tumbling over each other and biting and whining and yelping and, you know, little barks and stuff. And all of that is a way for them to learn how to interact well with each other so that if they bite too hard, they get bit back and they quickly learn to sort of moderate what they're doing. And indeed, Solo had none of that. So he thought he was the little prince of everything.
So you and your husband talked briefly about returning him. You didn't do that. What was it about Solo that made you want to keep trying with him?
He was an amazing pup. I mean, let's face it, he was really cute, and that helped. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a good-looking pup, but he was so smart and so focused. And as I say, he really was this kind of maniacal clown. From the get-go, he wanted to sort of show off for us and do something that he thought might garner a laugh or a reaction or get a toy. And so really within the first few days, we didn't know exactly what we had, but we knew that we had this kind of unusual being in the house. So, and really, you know, David only said, "Let's return him," because he knew that I would double down.
We can't do that. So ultimately, after a few months, you brought him to a trainer who sized him up pretty quickly, used a word we don't use on radio, and said, "That's okay. What do you want to do with him?"
Yeah. And, you know, Nancy Hook both sized him up, but she had already sized me up. Hmm. And she knew exactly what my strengths and weaknesses were. And first of all, she ordered me to stop funneling liver treats to him. and then said, look, we can work with this. And she had taught search and rescue. And because I teach at NC State, I couldn't sort of drop everything and leave the classroom. And that's when she explained this other kind of work that I hadn't heard of it. And she said, make him into a cadaver dog. And I said, what's that? Fantasizing briefly that it meant dead dog. And she explained, these are the dogs who, when somebody is missing and presumed dead, will go out and in some cases help locate those people. And those are sometimes the dogs that we see, I think, more commonly on sites of disasters. After the dogs that have gone in to find the living, within a couple of days, they will send in cadaver dogs to help recover the dead.
I like that you mentioned that Nancy Hook, the trainer, not only sized Solo up, but sized you up, because the book really drove home for me the idea that I think those of us who don't have anything to do with the field think of cadaver dogs as being sort of magical and they go off on their own through the wilderness. But in fact, they're only as successful as the relationship with their handlers is.
Yes, I joked about it a little bit. I said, you know, if I could just hand him the Camry keys and tell him to drive out to the site and then come back and tell me what he's found. But it's really true that not just me, but watching really good handlers with their dogs, it's always a partnership. And the handler is counting on the dog's nose and the dog's independence and the dog's honesty. And the dog is counting on the handler being enthusiastic about the search and offering proper rewards when it's time and sort of keeping the dog out of trouble so that the dog can concentrate on what he or she does best, right, which is getting into places a human can't necessarily get into and also smelling these things that we can sometimes smell, let's face it, but in many times we can't.
What have you learned about how a dog's ability to perceive scent compares with a human's ability? We all know dogs have much keener senses of smell, but is there like a way that we can understand that?
There is, but you know, what I found more than anything else is how much we still need to learn about the science of scent. And it's not that the dog's nose or the human nose are entirely black boxes. It's that there's so much that we don't know. And when I started researching this, and as I noted as a former reporter, I kind of went in and looked at all these statistics that a dog's nose is 10 times or 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times more sensitive than the human nose, and realized quickly that those numbers were made up. And you know, it is incredibly tempting, right? And in a way, it's very funny. Even a couple of weeks ago, there was an article about all the scents that a human nose could distinguish, and the researcher said that the human nose can distinguish a trillion different scents. Hmm. And another scientist came in shortly thereafter and said that the person had made a math error. And it was really only 1,000,000,000. So you see that we're still fooling around a little bit. But because of where scent goes over the top of the dog's, right, through the nostrils and over all these little turbinates, and the dog's nose, too, their nostrils work in stereo. And so that really helps dogs, as you can imagine, narrow down where scent is coming from pretty quickly, that the left nostril is getting a stronger scent and the dog turns left, right? Mm. And all of those functions help enormously. So what we know is that for most scents, dogs' noses are much better than our noses, although I'm sure that there are wine specialists who might beg to differ.
There is evidence that our evolutionary ancestors could smell better than we can. And I've wondered in the past if the fact that humans and dogs evolved together for, you know, a certain number of thousands of years, if we were able to kind of outsource our strong sense of smell to our dogs.
It's an interesting concept. And I think that archaeologists are starting to look at how coevolution, we know that we changed the dog, right? Mm-hmm. You know, all the stories about how the wolf became the dog and then how we turned dogs into pugs and poodles and Irish setters and German shepherds, right? But what we also have is the possibility, as you said, that the dog's nose and eyes and ears and hunting instincts and protective instincts helped humans and may have contributed. It's hard to know at this point, and it's so speculative, to humans paying a little less attention. And we know that the human nose can be trained, just like the dog's nose can be trained to become better. And I think that we in the West tend to kind of denigrate the sense of smell. And I think paying a little more attention to it, our noses would all get better.
What qualities besides a great nose does makes a dog suitable for scent work?
So there are so many qualities that, I mean, the list is so long. You need a dog that wants to work. You need a dog who is sort of physically fit and, as I sort of noted before, able to get in and around and over, right? If you think about a deep woods and the physical challenges of searching in deep woods or rough, rocky terrain, you know, the dog that is willing to scramble over boulders, right, or over deadfall in forests is the kind of dog that you want. And that means that the dog also has to be kind of, well, breeders or handlers would say environmentally hard.
Hmm.
But what that means is that this is the dog that doesn't mind going in the dark, going on different kinds of surfaces, running up metal staircases. And these are all things that handlers and trainers work with when they get young pups and as they develop them into working dogs to make all of that kind of environmental stuff challenging and fun for the dog so that when he or she goes on a difficult search, it's like no big deal.
Do dogs seem drawn to, or at least, I mean, sometimes they seem not bothered by scents that humans have a problem with or find revolting. Are there scents that dogs find offensive that bother them?
I'm sure that dogs don't love the smell of skunk, right? Especially when it's straight in their face. And there's certainly dogs where cadaver scent is something that they need to acclimatize to. I mean, one of the reasons that one of the founders of the field started working with cadaver dogs is that his bloodhounds would trail in thinking that they were going to find a live human and would actually get freaked out either by the body or the smell or both. And as Andy Redmond said, you know, oftentimes it was rare over tea kettle, although he didn't use that term because he wasn't on radio, with the dog going back the other direction, even though it had tracked beautifully in to somebody and then went, oh, my God, that person is deceased. I can't do this.
Oh, that's okay.
So the question is, I'm sorry, Chris,
no, please,
go ahead.
Please continue. Go ahead.
Well, the question is that we do know that dogs like protein and that they've survived for a long time by being able to find even decomposing meat, right? So many of them think it's pretty delightful.
We'll continue our conversation with Kat Warren in a few minutes. She's professor of science journalism and creative nonfiction at North Carolina State University and a cadaver dog handler. Her new book is called What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. It's out now in paperback. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning. With classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules, applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Kat Warren. She's a cadaver dog handler and professor of science journalism and creative nonfiction at North Carolina State University. Her new book is called What the Dog Knows: Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Kat, the road between really intractable puppy with some behavioral issues and highly trained, valuable volunteer cadaver dog is a long one. Tell us a little bit about the process. How does one get started teaching a dog that what you want it to do is go out into some place it's never been before and find human remains?
Well, it's the same way you actually what scent dog trainers say, put a foundation on any scent dog, right? So it could be a dog where you're telling it to go out and find cocaine or to find an invasive species. But what you do first is you find a way to isolate the scent. So if we're talking about human remains, as I describe in the book, my first trainer, Nancy Hook, had a wisdom tooth from her soon-to-be ex-husband, plus a little bloody gauze packing. And she simply put that in a bucket and had about four other buckets that didn't have the scent in. And Solo was led, actually he led me, from bucket to bucket to bucket until he sort of ducked his head in this one bucket and said, oh, that's kind of interesting. And he got an immediate reward. And so what you're doing is you're actually associating, it's just behavior modification, you're associating that smell with whatever the dog loves, whether it's a treat or a toy or a game of tug, right? And as you do that over a longer and longer stretch, right, then you can start putting these things out in different environments, and then you increase the challenge, right? So pretty soon you've put some stuff out that maybe was out for a week and it's the scent's gone all over. And so over time, you're working with different kinds of training materials because the scent of human remains is pretty complex, right? If you think from teeth to bone to somebody who's sadly sort of relatively recently deceased, you've got so many different things going on in that range. And so you're also, along all of that, you're exposing the dog to those things and also to all these different conditions. You know, what's it like if it's near water? What's it like if it's stashed in a barn somewhere, right? And so it's as broad and wide as your imagination can make it, right down to not putting out anything at all so that the dog has to search for a pretty long time and not get a reward, right? And know that that's okay too.
That's really interesting because, of course, you don't want to encourage the dog to come up with false positives. And so you need to find a way to keep their attention going. I hadn't thought about that challenge before.
Yes. And, you know, it depends on the dog. And the whole issue of sort of negative trainings is an interesting one because 9 out of 10 times, if you go out on a search, you're really clearing areas. You're not necessarily going to find something. And you need to, as they say, you know, sort of train as you search, which is to say, acclimatize the dog to not getting a reward constantly or not necessarily going out and finding 5 things every time he trains. So that is, as you say, those false positives can be really difficult because you don't want the dog to think that he can sort of go out there, find something easily, or be tempted to go out there and lie, because dogs do lie. They don't lie quite as much as humans, but, you know, a dog who gets used to saying, oh, it's here, and then you reward him without thinking about it, the next time the dog is going to go, hey, look what I got away with. Let me get my toy.
And you want to make sure that human handlers have integrity as well, as far as this goes, because if there's a criminal case tied to what you're investigating, some of that evidence might go to court.
It's really important. And it is, you know, for, I think, thoughtful, the majority, and good cadaver dog handlers, that is both the hope and the nightmare, right, that you end up being called into court. And you really have to show that your records are impeccable and that you've trained this dog and that the dog is reliable through that training, right? And because when things become court cases, you don't want an unreliable dog or unreliable handler, because you could end up sending somebody to prison who's not guilty.
So something I've learned from you is that, I'm going to ask people to recognize that there may be some slightly more graphic discussion coming up in the next few minutes, nothing completely terrible, but a human corpse smells more like a chicken corpse than like a pig corpse. The point being that different animals decompose in different ways. How do you teach a dog like Solo to pay attention to human remains and ignore that squirrel or possum that just, you know, died a natural death out in the woods somewhere? How do you teach them to distinguish?
Yes, and you know, that is a little graphic, but it's incredibly realistic. Because if you think about searching along the side of a highway, and that's not an infrequent kind of search, you're going to have lots of roadkill, let's face it. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a dog that says, deer, 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 not interested, possibly human. And so the way you do it is that there is a difference. And we don't know all the reasons yet that make those differences true. But what we do know is that you train dogs to ignore deer, pig, chicken, and you reward them on human remains. And they do know the difference, even right down to the bone. And I think that it's one of those things that can be enormously important. I remember Nancy, who, of course, is always about training the handler, what had me searching out in a field once, and she had put the training material underneath a dead goose. Hmm. And so Solo's over there, and he's sniffing and sniffing at this dead goose, and I'm about to get pretty cross when Nancy mutters into my ear, "You should trust your dog," right? Hmm. And of course, it does happen that somebody who does a clandestine burial will actually put a dead animal on top to throw investigators off.
Wow.
Right, in a burial. And so it is really important, and because out in the woods, you're going to encounter all sorts of deceased animals.
So Solo is a dog, and he understands that his job is to get this particular scent. He may not know what it is. He gets a game of tug of war, or he gets a liver treat. You, on the other hand, are a human being, and you recognize what it means when Solo makes a find. Can you talk about how you've learned to think about this and to process it and to make meaning of the work you do so that the realities of why you're there don't become too burdensome?
Yes, and I'll only speak for myself, because I think that everybody brings to some degree a slightly different kind of emotional stance to this. And so mine isn't for all handlers. And I did, by the way, retire Solo last year at the age of 10. Mm-hmm. He had worked for 8 years, which was a really good long time. And it was with great regret. And I'm actually now training another dog, another German Shepherd. But what it is that for me, two things happen. One is that when we go out, we know that the person is deceased. We're actually not going out with the hope of finding them alive. And that helps the mindset, because finding somebody can be incredibly important, either to law enforcement or family or friends, usually both. And knowing that, plus realizing that when you go out, your job is to make sure that the dog is set up to do his very best work, in Solo's case, his, and that the dog have a good time. And that really affects the mood that you bring to that, because you can't let your thinking about death run down the lead. And so for most handlers I know, you set that all aside. And what I would find is in the cases where I had a recovery or was thinking about the case, it was usually days later that any of those feelings of sadness would come up. But to tell you the truth, for the most part, if we were successful in a search, either clearing an area that really needed clearing where the dog was good and honest, or if we found somebody, to me, that was a good thing. It was a job well done. And I think that to a great degree, people bring, when they look at it from the outside, they bring two experiences, that is, their own loved ones or friends' deaths, or the stuff that you get from the media with shows like Bones or CSI, where in a way it's so graphic, right, that you kind of the ick feeling comes up as you watch these shows, which are designed often, right, to actually elicit that. And I must say that my entire experience of actual searches and finding somebody, it's never been ick.
How did you find your relationship with Solo changing as his training progressed and as he learned to really focus on the tasks that you were giving him?
You know, it's a funny and wonderful thing. I mean, I fell in love with him. I really did. But it's also, I had never had a partnership with a dog. I had had dogs where, you know, they were my companions and I had them in obedience, or they traveled with me and I adored them and vice versa. But with Solo, there really is this sense, and I think that a lot of handlers will say this, of for the time that you're out there, you're working with an equal, right? He's bringing his gifts and you're bringing your gifts, and there's this common goal. And it's an unusual feeling, and I so appreciate it, even in retrospect, as I'm working with a new dog, to have that sense that I sometimes had with Solo of just working as sort of one unit, right? But doing very different tasks.
So you write very movingly about the decision ultimately to retire Solo, and you explained earlier that dogs have to be sort of in top physical form and they need to be able to move through all kinds of terrain. So you're working now with your younger dog, Coda. And I wonder if there has to be joys and sorrows to starting all over again, you know, with the, you know, teaching the skills that you have beautifully developed in your older dog who is no longer physically up to the challenge, and then starting all over with a different animal.
Yes, what you said. it has been such an interesting challenge. And handlers talk about this. And the trainers that I work with, Mike Baker, whom I'm still training with, you know, as people have said, I have second dog syndrome, right? I'm working with a dog who is entirely different from Solo. I think that she'll never get there. I see her differently. She works differently, and I'm trying to learn how to understand her. And I have no memory of Solo ever being bad,
right,
ever being difficult. And to tell you the truth, in many ways, Solo was an ideal first dog, and also not ideal in that he was a very, very good dog with easy drives and just loving the work, and you could just switch on his switch and send him out, and he would work and work and work. And so I'm working with a new dog who is marvelous in her own way, But I'm learning how to be a better handler, I hope, with her, because I need to be, to get her excited, to get her interested, because of the differences between the two.
Yeah, I suppose the things that worked beautifully to motivate Solo won't work for Coda and vice versa. They're still coexisting in the same house together, right?
They love each other. It's really, I never thought that this would happen with Solo. I mean, he fell in love with her instantly, and I don't understand. You know, something happened over the years. He's been just an amazing friend and mentor to her, even when she's a complete little pill. He's patient. He's kind. He's generous with his toys. You know, if there are two marrow bones out there, within 3 minutes, both of them belong to her. You know, and Solo just looks at her and you can see him kind of grinning and going, yeah, no big deal.
You know what I love about that story, Kat, is in the beginning of the book you write about you had an older Irish setter who was very gentle, and Solo would attack her so much that you sprayed bitter apple on her ears and on her tail to, like, give her the chance, and she wouldn't really fight back. And, like, maybe those early lessons actually stuck, that behavior, that pattern of kindness.
Something, and, you know, look, I think, and when you come right down to it, Solo had a really, really good background. He had a great puppyhood. He, in a way, it's almost as though at the end, that sort of emotional stuntedness around dogs has faded away a lot. We have a new puppy in the neighborhood, and Solo is just really good to him. Now, he tends to ignore that puppy. Compared to Coda, Solo is constantly trolling to get a toy in her mouth, right? He's constantly enticing her.
We're speaking this hour with Kat Warren, who is professor of science journalism and creative nonfiction at North Carolina State University and a cadaver dog handler. Her new book, out in paperback, is called What the Dog Knows: Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. We'll come back to the conversation in a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with college professor and cadaver dog handler Kat Warren. Her new book is called What the Dog Knows: Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. You can join us via email to think@kera.org, and that's where we hear from Michael in Dallas, who asks, what kinds of things can I do with my dog to become a good handler? What kind of exercises can we do to increase her ability?
Oh, that's such a great question. And there are so many things that you can do with your dogs to actually, whether they're pet dogs or potential working dogs, to increase their independence, their drive. And one of the things that I think that we do, and it's so unconscious, is that we often teach our dogs a kind of learned helplessness, right? This is where we don't stand back and let the dog figure out increasingly difficult problems, right? And one of the things that I think we all want to do is sort of step in and help the dog. And yet what I want to teach the dog is it's okay to push that door open and go in that dark room. It's okay to jump up and over the things that look like, oh, potentially might hurt the dog if he slips a little bit. And so that combination of letting the dog learn, plus all those simple things that if the dog, for instance, loves toys, hiding the toys in different spots in the yard or in the house and encouraging the dog to go find that toy, right? All those things. And there is also something called canine nose work, which is a really fun new discipline, which is like agility or obedience. Canine nose work is where you teach the dogs to go after different sort of, actually, they're essential oils like birch, and I think there's carnation. And it just teaches the dogs to use their noses and do the same things that a narcotics dog might do. But what it does is it teaches the dogs confidence and drive, and it's fun.
That's fascinating. My our dog is useless, and we're okay with that. But she's quite smart. But if you say, "Where's your ball?" she looks at you like, "Yeah, where is it? Can you throw it for me?" And she doesn't know to go. She'll chase it all day long, but if she's lost track of it, she has no clue. And I wonder if I were to teach her how to, you know, associate the balls with a certain scent, if she could find them when we ask for them.
She absolutely could, but she's trained you very well, obviously.
Yes, she has.
If you go find it, it really is a lot less work for her. Hmm. And my pup Coda very often will be very sloppy because I'll use a chuck it to exercise her, and with two balls, right, one that I throw and one that she's bringing back, and she's so eager that sometimes she'll pop it out and it'll go halfway across the yard, and she'll just go over and she'll glance at it and then think, oh, you'll go get it, right? And it's like, no, you actually have to bring it and drop it at my feet, right?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Yvette in Dallas. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. This is just completely fascinating to us. We have a 3-year-old bloodhound who's so precious and fun, but there are 6 of us in the family and 6 family members, and I was wondering if she can be trained to search for each different person's scent.
She absolutely can be trained to do that, and you know, 3 years old, if she's got the interest and the drives. Now, I will say that bloodhounds tend not to work for toys. The bloodhounds I know have loved Spam or really gross wiener dogs, but one of the things that you can do is start her with little what we call puppy runaways, and that is that you start her out where she gets to see the person running away and hiding behind a tree, say just like 50 feet away, and you kind of hold her back and actually, as though you're letting her pull and tug as she watches the person, and then you let her go, right? And when she goes and finds the person, you know, immediate reward with the hot dogs or whatever it is that she loves, right? And then over time, you can end up doing those scent distinguishing things where you use gauze pads, literally, and give her the scent of that particular person. And bloodhounds at more complicated levels will ignore the 4 trails of your 4 family members and go after the trail of the person whose scent is on that piece of gauze.
Wow. You and Solo took part in a really interesting exercise, and I was astonished that this would even be possible. You went to, I think it was West Virginia, to look for unmarked graves of people who had been held in slavery.
Yes, and actually, we went to, this was just over the border in South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
I did go to West Virginia, and I watched Kathy Hulbert and several other really good handlers looking for the unmarked slave graves. And with Solo, we actually were invited to South Carolina, and it was to look for Revolutionary era grave sites that were unmarked. And it happened that it was on a plantation that down the hill there were also numerous unmarked grave slaves and unmarked graves that were even sort of after the Civil War. And it is fascinating. And still a little speculative, but we do know that dogs can help pinpoint, not with utter precision necessarily, places, graves that are several hundred years old.
When you consider this, I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, how alive a dog's world, pardon the pun, must be with scent at all times. If it can be a couple of hundred years and there's even a possibility that a dog could perceive that, you have to wonder how they, just to focus on anything at all, how they turn off their perception of scent. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know absolutely what you're saying, and I do think it's, you know, it's like people's minds, right, when you try to shut off your mind to concentrate on one particular thing. And I think that what makes good scent dogs good is literally that ability to say, I'm going to shut out the other things that I might be interested in smelling, and I'm going to be looking for these scents. And when we think about the very faint scent coming off an old grave, we're not talking about a lot of scent, but obviously there's something in the air column, mm-hmm. right, for the dog's nose to pick up. And it's really what I love most about watching well-trained scent dogs, right? It doesn't matter whether they're looking for ecstasy or crack cocaine or bed bugs or human remains, is that concentration to say, you know, I know there's so many other smells in this room, but this is the one that I'm looking for right now. And this is, and it's almost as though you can see them doing the same thing that, you know, for instance, a surgeon is doing, right? Concentrating on a surgery, where it narrows down to that exact task, right?
Kat, I'm sure that you've seen people who have good dogs and good intentions but are not cut out to be handlers. Can you talk about some of the qualities and what it takes to be a good cadaver dog handler or just working dog handler?
Sure, because there are, you know, every other day I think that I'm actually not that good a handler. So I can talk very much about it. And I mean that seriously. I've been doing this since 2004, and I learn things every day. I consistently make mistakes. I think that what good handlers bring to the table is first, patience. Secondly, really impeccable timing in rewarding the dog. And thirdly, an ability to be flexible, right, and learn. In other words, I do try to learn from my mistakes. I don't always. But the fact is that you have to have all three of those things to work with dogs. And you also have to realize, and this is, I think that this can be, it's both hard and easy, is that a dog and handler are always just one tool, right? Mm-hmm. When somebody is missing and presumed dead, it's an entire team that is brought to get a resolution on that, right? And I think that very good handlers come to the party or the search with a sense of humbleness, right? We're fortunate to be asked to be called to those places, and it's never the dog and handler alone that's going to, quote-unquote, solve a case.
We have an email here from Meredith who wants to know if you have suggestions for an owner of a very curious and smart German Shepherd when we are gone from the house. He has puzzles and masters them easily, and I've run out of mind games for my dog during the day.
Yes. I mean, I think that this is something that we all struggle with, right? All of us who have jobs and want to have dogs in our lives. And dogs are social animals, right? And so when they're alone all day, many of them are going to want to get into trouble, right? At home right now, Solo is out of a crate, but Coda is crated because I know perfectly well that she would find some mischief to get up to mm-hmm. if she weren't in her crate. So there are no easy answers for leaving a dog alone for 8 hours a day. It's true that the mind games and everything else can help a little bit, but ultimately that dog wants to be with his owner or her owner and be mentally stimulated. And it's hard for that to happen when they're alone.
How do you know when you're done in a location? You said a lot of what you do ends up being clearing places to make sure that there's not a body there. How can you be sure that the search has been thorough enough?
You never know.
Hmm.
I mean, I know that that sounds... The fact is that I do write about the fact that I think that every handler's nightmare is that they feel as though they've cleared a place and then no body is found. And until there's a resolution that person is found somewhere else, there's a part of you that always wonders in a search of any complexity. You do your very best. You trust the dog. You often, if there is any sort of interest expressed by the dog, you have teams where you have another dog go in with another handler, not telling them where the dog has expressed interest to see if you can get some confirmation, right? But ultimately, at the end of the day, you can't know. You can hope that you've done your very, very best and that the dog has done his or her best, and that's often what you're left with.
What's the time commitment for you? How much time do you spend training in between the calls you get to actually go out and do what you've trained for?
You know, it's different for everyone. And I'm in a situation with Coda right now where I try to train her a couple times a week and for a number of hours. It's not that she's searching training for several hours, right? Because you're bringing different dogs in and out as you train. And different teams have different standards. But the fact is that regular trainings are absolutely necessary for a dog to be deployed. I mean, that's the bottom line. And one of the reasons I probably could have kept Solo going another year or so, but the fact is that I was training Coda, and I didn't, with my job, have time to properly keep two dogs in training, right? So I chose Coda. Poor Solo.
Kat, I get the sense that Solo is much loved and well cared for, though.
He's pretty happy. The fact is that I was out with him this morning, and both dogs were romping in the yard, I think, three separate times this morning. So
nice.
Retrieving balls. So.
Kat Warren's new book is What the Dog Knows, Scent, Science, and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. Kat, thank you so much for making this time for us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was a real pleasure, and thank you for the wonderful conversation.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.